Support for this episode of the podcast comes from our patrons at Patreon. Head to patreon.com/chasingEarhart to join the chase and become a patron today. Chasing Earhart, the discussion panel, happens in just 7 days. Join us at Benedictine College in beautiful Atchison, Kansas, as project guest astronaut Abby, Shasta Ways, Kate Jerome, Sammy Morris, Jessica Cox, Tom Detweiler, Scott Philbrook, Forrest Burgess, Tom King, Dick Spink, Larry Inman, Lisa Cotham, Ann Pellegrino, Bill Snavely, Gary LaPook, and Douglas Westfall take the stage for the most in-depth discussion ever on the life and disappearance of Amelia Earhart. Go to chasingearhart.rsvpify.com. That's chasingearhart.rsvpify.com to reserve your seats for this landmark panel event. On the morning of July 2nd, 1937, Amelia Earhart and her navigator Fred Noonan disappeared over the Pacific Ocean without a trace. 81 years later, all over the world lie scattered pieces of their puzzle, waiting to be put together. Welcome to Season 2 of the Chasing Earhart Podcast.
We're on line of position 157337, running north and south.
I'm going to talk to you about Amelia Earhart and me finding the briefcase in 1944. They would have been wet. They're not wet.
And had the opportunity to speak about an American woman pilot executed by Japanese Army while in captive prison before World War II after her plane crashed within the Pacific region. This woman was Amelia Earhart.
We believe Amelia came upon activities which she could not have described later and remained alive.
What really happened to Amelia Earhart? Since Earhart and her navigator disappeared during their around-the-world flight attempt in 1937, the world has searched in vain for an answer to this question. The culmination of 13 years of research into this tantalizing mystery, the Earhart Enigma, retracing Amelia Earhart's last flight, brings to life Earhart's final days in an attempt to reconstruct what exactly took place. Offering candid assessments of prevailing theories about Earhart's fate, author Dave Horner marshals evidence from a variety of sources, arguing that Earhart was neither lost at sea nor wrecked on Nikumaroro. Integrating information garnered from numerous interviews, Pacific Islander folklore, and U.S. and Japanese military documents, Horner argues instead that Earhart ventured north of her intended destination in search of a place to land her Lockheed Electra. Blending drama, mystery, and shocking revelations with the steady balance of an objective investigator, Horner's findings provide a definitive answer to this fascinating riddle. Tonight, Season 2 of the Chasing Earhart podcast kicks off with our 51st episode. Dave calls in to discuss his book, The Earhart Enigma, the legacy of the disappearance of Amelia Earhart and Fred Noonan, and why he believes that the Earhart Enigma has captured the imagination of the world for 81 years.
Our guest today is Dave Horner. He's an author. He wrote The Earhart Enigma, came out back in 2013. It's titled The Earhart Enigma, Retracing Amelia Earhart's Last Flight. Dave, it's an absolute honor to have you aboard the Chasing Earhart podcast. Thank you for coming aboard, sir.
My pleasure, sir.
So what I like to always do with all my interviews is I like to have our guests kind of introduce themselves a little bit by telling our folks out there that are listening about their professional background and their educational background. Can you do that for me, please?
Yeah, I'll try to be brief. How much time do I have? 10 seconds or 15?
Oh, you have all the time you need, sir.
I grew up in Virginia. So I'm a Virginian and proud to be one. And my mother was a school teacher, and my father was a banker. And made up my mind I wasn't smart enough to be a school teacher. And after looking at how we struggled in those early years, I decided I didn't want to be a banker either because I didn't pay enough money. I needed more. So anyway, I graduated from the University of Virginia. Took the first job offer I had, which was with U.S. Steel in Pittsburgh, day and realized all the top executives of the major steel companies didn't know how to make steel.
Huh.
And so they had created a really, exuberant management training program for those who might qualify. And for some reason, I did qualify. So that's why I went with to Pittsburgh for U.S. Steel and with my new bride. Went into the management training program, and the first thing they taught me was, I don't know if you remember the old U.S. Steel Hour on TV where they the siren's going off and as the show comes on the air and has a warning, and then all of a sudden there's an explosion and they tap the furnace and you see all the molten steel coming out.
Right.
And that was my first job, to learn how to set off the dynamite charges that did that. So I gradually progressed through that for about 6 months, and my draft call came up. I'd been in the Navy Reserve, so I went in the Navy and was assigned to USS Aldebaran, AF-10, and it was an armed cargo ship, primarily with refrigerated holds for carrying food supplies back and forth to the Sixth Fleet in the Mediterranean, primarily, and other places. We were on a few secret missions at that time off Cuba and then off of Russia. So, I've been sort of ran my own charter boat when I had was a few days off or could pick up a party of three or four off the Virginia coast for fishing and sport fishing and that sort of thing. And I had an interest in the early days when scuba came out, and a lot of people were very interested in it, but I did form the first pro dive shop in the mid-Atlantic area, in Virginia Beach, Virginia, where I'd been lifeguarding during the summer. And it grew, and I became known to be one of the early scuba enthusiasts in that part of the country. And then I had the Decor diving equipment franchise for Virginia, and then was their rep for the South. So I kind of covered Virginia to Florida and met a lot of people and taught her. I've had how many people I've taught safe skin and scuba diving too. But so my early books were tied in with the diving activities. And since I helped the YMCA organize the first, certainly one of the first certification programs for safe scuba diving.
Wow.
In the country, I've been very active in that ever since then, and been interested in some of the sunken ships that made interesting diving sites, and several contracts with the state of Florida for salvage on some of the lost galleon wrecks off of Bass Shores, as well as the Bahamas, and probably one of the biggest undertakings in this connection was a contract with the government of Ecuador.
I see.
Which was one of the most difficult things I've ever done, even though I spoke a little Spanish. Most of my contracts had been 75 for my company, for the Salvor, and 25 for the country or the property, the territory of the state which you're working in. That went fine. It was good in the state of Florida. It was good in the Bahamas. But I couldn't do any better than 50-50 with the government of Ecuador. So we did get fortunate and located probably the most major Spanish shipwreck in the history of Spain's sailings to and from the New World.
Wow.
Off of Ecuador, it was lost in 1652. And it was loaded with primarily silver pieces of eight, minted in the fabulous mountain of silver in Peru. And that in itself is a heck of a story, because that really has never been told, because it was just an absolute mountain of silver. And it was what really catapulted Spain into becoming one of the richest countries in the world, if not the wealthiest.
Wow.
And no one knew that there was a mountain of silver there. They knew there was some evidence of silver and some evidence of gold. And this place was called Potosí. And it's down, today it's in fairly near Lima, Peru. But
okay.
It was an absolute mountain of silver, and the stories of the horrors of problems working inside a mountain, and a lot of the natives were killed or fell from high cliffs and died just to get to the core, and then of course it had to be refined. So it's one super fantastic story, which I'm working on now. But
wow.
Anyway, so I've been interested in the Spanish and the lost ships and ever since I was a kid. So I've been very active in all that sort of thing. And I've had contracts and worked around the world, particularly in the Mediterranean and the Atlantic and some of the islands and notable reefs that may have stopped some of the galleon. So that's been sort of a... my sweet wife said some years ago it's been a sickness with me because, anyway, I've tried to overcome that sickness and keep other people in mind that they get tired of hearing all this stuff. But So I fell in love with Amelia when all the controversy came up about what happened and where was she. And I have probably close to 15 years of study and travel and research on it, and I was really lucky to make some discoveries that no one else had that show up in the book. One of the most obvious ones was a letter. It was an SOS letter that was written and found in a bottle floating off that was thrown off somewhere in the Mediterranean, and I guess you're familiar with that because I have copies of it in the book.
Yeah, I've heard of that letter, and I've a couple of other of our guests have actually mentioned that letter. For the guests that that haven't heard about that letter, can we talk a little bit about that and kind of that origin and how that letter came about?
That's a whole chapter in the book, so that helps make the book worth what it costs, which is modest. But it's an amazing story, and you'd think most people would just pass it off as fiction, and it couldn't possibly have happened.
Right.
But and I've spent a lot of time and money and travel around the world to try to run down a few people who knew something about it, and or who, in the early days of so many people been interested in what really happened to Amelia Earhart, and most of them are no longer around. They were fascinated over the fact that someone actually saw her sometime after she disappeared.
Right.
And this bottle washes up on this delightful little beach over in France. It's near the Burgundy wine growing and vintning region there on the Mediterranean. It's really on the Atlantic. And a French gal walking down, taking her evening stroll down the boardwalk area there along the beach, notices a tiny bottle floating in with the evening surf. The surf wasn't up that day. It was just sort of a calm evening.
Mm-hmm.
And she can't resist going down to pick it up. And I've got an illustration of her doing just that, still in her sandals, but with a couple of inches of water, she's in. And she pulls it up to the soon-to-be setting sun and sees some notes inside this bottle.
Wow.
And a lock of golden brown hair.
Jeez.
And so she takes it back up near the boardwalk area there and sits down. She works the cork loose and gently extracts from the bottle two little rolled up pieces of paper.
Wow.
And I've got copies of that little sweet little message in the book.
Yeah.
And I try to tell the story as it best it could be told. But it was obviously a person that had met her in the, I won't say sanctuary, but in the jail that she was in the islands there.
Right.
They were in the process of transferring her from the spot that she came down, basically in the marshals.
Right.
to Saipan, which was a 1,000 miles distant, but it was the then Japanese headquarters for their military.
Right.
In that part of the world, and she made several stops along the way, and I followed later, knowing those stops, and found some people who had seen her, identified her, described her, being very closely watched by the Japanese military.
Right.
So, you know, the book has not only the personal, lots of personal descriptions of her trials and tribulations during that period of time, but her navigator friend Newman's also. And
right.
I'm trying to bring it to life, and I'm happy that it did win the Silver Medal for Best Nonfiction that year.
Well, one of the many reasons why I wanted to have you as a guest on the project is because, you know, I read your book twice, and I found the book really to be fascinating. It's very well written. One of the questions I wanted to ask you in this interview was just about the Japanese capture hypothesis in general. Obviously, it's, you know, the U.S. government stands behind the fact that she simply just crashed and sank, and that was kind of all there was to it. And there's so many different proponents of that, of course, and we'll get into that with other guests as well. But is it really, has it been surprising to you that, you know, with all the spotlight that the Japanese capture hypothesis has kind of received lately with the Lost Evidence documentary and all the good work they're doing over there with that, and all the different books and all the different authors that are kind of writing about this and talking about this and kind of trying to bring this story to light. What do you make of all that as far as that's concerned?
Well, the only thing I can say about it is the Japanese still don't admit to bombing Pearl Harbor, so, you know, take it for what you want.
So what do you, I mean, you know, let's talk a little bit about the capture and about, you know, what happened. So what are you, thinking that happened at that point? She obviously was, obviously went down somewhere in the Marshalls. Can you talk a little bit about what you believe happened at that point and maybe how you believe they got to that point in the first place?
Yes, I've personally interviewed, I don't know how many people throughout that region. The way they went about it was very respectful, and Amelia and many of them very careful in how they said and what they said. So they knew it was probably a big deal for the Japanese, and still they haven't admitted it. But I got from many people in the islands a very secure feeling about their commentary and what they had to say. And I think that probably certainly 90% of everything they told me was true. If some may have been glorified a little bit for whatever purposes, but I think, and they were all telling virtually the same story.
Right.
And Amelia was a fighter. She wasn't going to just crash and sink. And she knew exactly how much fuel she had left, as did Noonan. And so they said, we can't find Howland Island. And there were lots of reasons for that. There was a terrible, very heavy rainstorm for about 6 hours in the middle of the night, around midnight, right after they saw the lights there at the island that they were looking for the light on around midnight. And so they were flying strictly by compass, and they got into a strong headwind from the southeast, which tended to set them northward of the course.
Right.
They weren't sure how far northward. There wasn't any beacons or day beacons or anything they could find to, even after sunrise, to tell them exactly where they were. And they couldn't find the island. They flew over the earlier islands at 3 a.m., 4 a.m. in the morning.
Yeah.
And so they knew that the islands to the north, that they had a general chart on that sort of thing, and they knew that probably if they were going to find a place, if they couldn't find Howland, they had to find some kind of place. It wasn't a seaplane. They had to find some kind of place to put that airplane down.
Right.
And they knew exactly how much or how little fuel they had left. And so they headed for what they thought was the nearest island or islands. If you look at Millie Atoll and look at where Howland Island is, you can just visualize that taking place if you put yourself in Amelia and Fred Noonan's shoes. And he was a very good navigator.
Yeah.
And so I'm an ex-navigator, so I can appreciate what Noonan knew and learned and how well he took a star sign or whatever with the sextant or whatever he was using. So,
yeah,
I appreciate the detail and the seriousness that this man and this woman had to try to save themselves and not just give up and say, we're going to go and see, let's just go on and get it over with. And so they had these islands in sight when the engine started sputtering, and they knew it was probably this Emilie Atoll where they were heading, and it was a pretty wide or elongated atoll. They were very fortunate that when the engine started sputtering, they were right in that region, and they glided on in, and apparently Noonan was in the starboard, in the right co-pilot seat,
yeah,
and was thrown into the windshield, because from the very beginning, even some of the locals, people that saw the plane on the reef, you know, the story is that one of these men, they thought there were two men. One was obviously dressed in long pants, and Noonan with his blood coming off of his head.
Yeah.
He'd been thrown right into the windshield. So, all that is, I can visualize it, and I think most anyone familiar with the story can understand it and accept it. And I think the most interesting thing for me was that everybody with whom you talked or that you spoke later that remembered it, or whose mother or father remembered it, in my case,
yeah,
that they thought it was two men, one of whom hit his head and was bleeding, and it was wrapped in a shirt or some sort of white bedding or something. As they were picked up and came with the Japanese that took them ashore.
Yeah, yeah.
The other most interesting thing is when they took Amelia and Fred, they took the plane as well. And most everybody that have questions about that said, how in the world could they have done that?
Right.
I don't go into a lot of detail on it, but basically, they had a number of military there. At that Millie Atoll and other nearby atolls. And so it wouldn't take them too long to get a ship in there that could approach, or a smaller vessel that could tow a barge in there. And they could sink the aft end of that barge, fill it with water where it would be low enough for them to drag and push and pull that plane up on it. And then balance that off by pumping the water out and then going to the other end, shifting it to the other level of the barge and sinking that in so they could get the plane reasonably balanced on it.
Yeah.
Before they used that float as a tow. It took a lot of doing, yeah, but they didn't have anything else to do.
Yeah.
So that's how they transported her, and everybody that saw it remembers it. And one of the folks I interviewed, he came in about noon. He came in that morning after, everybody could walk to class and walk to and from the school. He said, we're going to shut down studies today about lunchtime, and I want everybody to go down to the harbor before they go home, and they'll see an interesting sight. This language was passed on to others, and it just so happened that a few of those others were still around when I came along. I was able to talk to a few, or at least to their wife or somebody in the family,
right,
who conveyed pretty much the same message of how they were brought there and why. It's to talk to some of those people, it's just an amazing story that they all tell it the same way.
Let me ask you this question, because I think it's interesting. A lot of folks, depending on what you subscribe to and what you believe, a lot of folks believe that she was actually shot down, and because she was in fact on a spy mission, to take photographs of the Marshall Islands. I'm sure you've heard that many times. But you're kind of theorizing, and you talk about in your book that she had to put the plane down, and they put the plane down and end up being in the Marshalls, and she just kind of was in the wrong place at the wrong time. Is that kind of sort of what you believe happened?
She wasn't shot at, but she was at the wrong place at the wrong time.
Right.
But she didn't have any choice, and I don't think she even knew the Japanese occupied or were occupying those islands at that particular time, because they were building a landing field right there on that atoll. So I wasn't there then, so I can't know it all.
Right.
I don't know it all.
Right.
But the stories, most of them, that make sense, I accept those. And I've tried to be straightforward on my writing and telling the story as it came to me.
Yeah.
And I did pick up some adventurous commentary from others, and I may have used a little of it.
Right.
But they were people that I believed in and trusted, and so I don't apologize for anything.
Yeah.
I think most of it is pretty close to being accurate.
So let me ask you this, Dave, because I think it's important. You touched on it earlier in our conversation that you said that the Japanese, obviously haven't admitted to anything. And, a lot of folks we've talked to, and I think you might agree that, in the Marshalls, with the release of the commemorative stamps and all that, that they've kind of put out there publicly, it really is sort of common knowledge that she just, her and Fred were there. It just is what it is kind of thing. But the Japanese government, has never really officially, obviously stated, yes, we had Amelia Earhart under capture. At this time period, and this is kind of what came of her. I'm going to ask you to speculate a little bit. What do you think would happen if the Japanese government came out and officially released, a statement or some kind of a documentation that might have been hidden away or something that states that, yes, she was in fact here and this is what in fact happened to her? What do you think that would do to the Earhart community at large, to the world's perception of Amelia Earhart and in her legacy, essentially? What do you think that would do to her, all that? How would that affect it?
Well, if anybody's read my book, they know my position. And, they haven't read it, they should, because I've said it just the way I would say it to you, right, in answer to that question,
Sure.
It's an awful thing that the Japanese, they still haven't admitted to Pearl Harbor. And so, they're one of our best trading partners today, and I think they're getting stronger all the time.
Yeah.
And they probably will be a close ally if we finally turn around and do to North Korea what we need to do to North Korea.
Right.
But, I don't know all the answers.
Right.
But I feel that everything that I've stated in writing this book and in evaluating the admittance is as good as I can get it to be, because there's not a lot of baloney in there.
Yeah.
And there's not a lot of over-dramatization either.
Right. What I'd like to do is ask you about Fred Noonan, if we could, because I know he gets kind of largely kind of pushed out of the picture, and with our project, and I think with our project and what we're attempting to do is, we're attempting to shine some of that spotlight on Fred Noonan, because he was an incredible navigator and very obviously one of the best on the planet at what he did, and extremely brave to go ahead and make this journey with Amelia when he did. He was newly remarried at the time that he left. He was looking to kind of start another chapter in his life. And can we talk a little bit about Fred Noonan and kind of his role in, obviously we all know he was her navigator, but was it simply just navigation, or, was he obviously kind of a partner in this with her, right?
I wish I could have known him.
Yeah, but, me too.
As I recall, I think his mother died when he was 8 or 9 years old.
Mm.
And he worked his way to the West Coast from Illinois or somewhere, and signed aboard one of the sailing vessels and worked his way up through all the different jobs there and became one of the finest seagoing navigators. And then when the airplane came along, he wanted to fly, and he became one of the best airborne air navigators.
Yeah.
Simply because of his tremendous stay with it capabilities in learning and sailing on the vessels where it was, you got into a storm and had too much sail up, you rolled over. This was a lot of good lessons there,
right.
Whether you're a navigator or not.
Right.
So yeah, I think I really would have enjoyed knowing Fred Noonan because I'd like to grow up and be like him.
Yeah, he was definitely one of the all-time greats, I think, and one of the pioneers of navigation. What I want to kind of segue into is the actual the Japanese capture itself, if we can. I mean, she's, you know, a lot of people believe that she ended up at Garapan prison and that she eventually died of dysentery there, or that she was executed. I mean, there's kind of different pathways you can go. Can you tell us and talk to our listeners about what you believe happened ultimately to Amelia Earhart and Fred Noonan?
I believe everything I said in the book is correct, and that she and Noonan survived long enough to have crashed in the Marshall Islands, Amelia Atoll, and were picked up. The Japanese were throughout those islands, and you know what they were doing: building bases, building dormitories.
Mm-hmm.
Deepening channels for submarines and harbors, you know, getting ready for Pearl Harbor.
Yeah.
And that, the more I think about that, the more furious I get.
Right.
We haven't been tough enough on Japan. And you know, somebody in our State Department of Government should say, damn it all, show us those records that you have.
Do you think that's ever going to happen? I mean, and do you think that that's, I mean, what do you think the odds are?
They may have already done that.
Oh, okay. Gotcha. If let's speculate a little further. I mean, if let's say that, you know, hypothetically that you're correct and they may have already shared that information with the U.S. government, being that we're kind of allies at this point now and it's a totally different situation these days. What does the U.S. government do with that information? What do you think happens?
Well, what do they do with a lot of their information?
yeah, that's very true. I guess I'm just trying to wonder if this will ever come out, you think. I mean, I know that, you know, if this is indeed what happened to Amelia Earhart and Fred Noonan, it really changes a lot of things. And I'm just wondering if we think that that'll ever come out and officially, and if that will ever be put to rest. And do you think that the U.S. government, I guess what would be the fallout of that for the U.S. government? Let's talk about that. I mean, if they, let's say 20 years ago, they found out ultimately exactly what happened with, you know, tangible proof, and they just have obviously never disclosed it to the public. Let's say they decide to do a press conference tomorrow where they put out a statement officially tomorrow and say that this is exactly what happened and she was in Japanese custody. What do you think the fallout is there?
Oh, I think most people probably suspect that, and everybody's got their own opinion. Most people on the street don't know as much about what Amelia and Fred may have done as you and I might.
Right.
It's hard for people who make serious mistakes in government to turn around and go back and say, I'm sorry, I was wrong.
Yeah.
And America has that problem, too, with coming being forthright on some things.
Yeah.
And so they say, well, no news is good news. Let's just forget the whole thing.
Yeah.
And so, you can what-if it forever.
Right.
And people will be.
Do you think ultimately this, you know, the truth will ever come out? Do you think we'll ever know exactly what happened to Amelia Earhart? I mean, definitively. I mean, I know that the folks that believe that she was in fact captured, and, you know, with everything, considering everything, do you think we'll ever definitively know, and it'll be accepted as public knowledge that this is exactly what happened to her?
You know, the way things happened on all of this, I mean, obviously, message in the bottle was a very, everybody that's studied it feels like it was not a fake.
Right.
And it wasn't someone doing Halloween tricks on someone. We can't tell everybody everything because there's some things that have to be protected.
Yeah.
And for whatever reason, because of whoever said. So, you know, I respect, for the most part, government and the way it's being run. But then again, there are lots of areas in which we can certainly improve greatly.
Sure.
And there's a lot of people that are in positions that they shouldn't be in.
Yeah.
And so forth. But, you know, that's life. And it's whether it's in your own company or in the U.S. government, it's life.
Yeah.
Get used to it. Do the best you can.
Yeah.
Help others help themselves.
Right. Well, let's segue a little bit into, and we'll kind of start wrapping up the interview here in a little bit, but I want to segue into her impact and her legacy. Obviously, we've touched on it a little bit in this conversation today. She's always being talked about, and she's always being kind of kept in the news and kept in the media and kept on the minds of the general public. Can you, from your standpoint as an author and someone who's done a lot of deep research into Earhart and her life and what happened ultimately to her, can you speak a little bit about her impact and her legacy and why she still is so relevant?
I think it's because of her makeup and personality, primarily herself. It's, of course, the disappearance and the manner in which she left us is a very good, you know, it could be any kind of story you want to make. And so it's a fascinating thing, what really happened.
Right.
Who was the real Amelia Earhart?
Right.
And because they were beautiful people, she and Bennett, you know, it's makes it even more glorious and glamorous to think about and say, what if?
Yeah.
So I don't deny anyone the opportunity to do that and think, maybe she wasn't killed by a firing squad.
Yeah.
You know, and there are people in the islands that will say otherwise, that are very responsible people.
Right.
And some of them were friends of mine that I trusted.
Yeah.
But, you know, they have their views and their parents' views, and they, for the most part, loved and respected their parents. And so that's their story, and they're sticking with it. And they have every right to.
Yeah, I agree. You know, if and I always ask this question towards the end of all the interviews that I do, but in the end, if Amelia, hypothetically, obviously she'd be 120 years old now, I think, but if she were alive today and she kind of could look back at all this and look back at everything that's happened since her disappearance, all the work being done on the various hypotheses and you know, her kind of whole worldwide, you know, fan base and just everybody who kind of still looks to her, what do you think ultimately she would think of her own legacy, and what do you think she would want her own legacy to be, and all that?
I don't know that she would think about it too much, because she did, when she was alive, she did what she wanted to, number one, and then she did mostly probably what she thought was right, number two.
Yeah.
And so I haven't tried to psychoanalyze her in any way, and I'm not capable of doing that.
Sure.
Noonan, I don't think would bluff anything to any degree himself.
He, right.
You know, he was a responsible navigator. He had to believe the sextant reading that he got and the location after he plotted it and went through all the formulas, getting several star sites and working each one out to have it to see where his position was.
Right.
One was off a little bit, the other might be right on, the other might not be. So, I mean, you know, going to sea, whether it's in that day and time or this one, you can get into all kinds of difficulties that you don't face every day.
Right.
And so you have to be flexible and, as I say, agile, mobile, and versatile. And Noonan was that, and Amelia was that, and they, because they were good sailors and good airmen, air women, you know, they disappeared, and people feel bad about it. And we really miss them today. I do.
Yeah.
Because I would have liked to ask some of those very questions you just asked.
Right.
To each of them.
Right.
And I've spent a lot of time trying, particularly the people who were so energetically describing, because they told the story several times, they were getting pretty good at it.
Yeah.
Describing, you know, maybe the animation of one of Amelia or of Noonan, or one was ticked off and the other was just sort of straightforward. You get all kinds of descriptions of them from people over there that they imagined it was this way, or either just conceived that it was that way,
right,
and are telling you, just because, to be a friend, you ask the question, here's your answer.
Yeah.
And so, you know, it's, I think basically most of the stories follow a similar pattern, and we will never know the exact pattern of what happened. When you talk to enough people, you get enough feeling about it, and sometimes some people have a very strong feeling on it, and are very upset about it.
Yeah.
But, you know, life goes on, and so we have to try to go on with
it. I agree. Well stated. Okay. Any last thoughts on, you know, before we let you go, any last thoughts of you know, on Earhart and Noonan or anything like that, or on the Earhart Enigma that you want to leave our listeners with?
No, I think everything in my book I've proven pretty much through the work and the research and the comments of others on Amelia, and I believe firmly that she didn't just crash and sink somewhere. She's not on the bottom of the sea, never having been found. And I further believe that she and Noonan did everything they possibly could do. And running out of gas in the airplane, and then crashing, and then being pitched around and moved around unmercifully or unfriendly by the Japanese military, who were doing simply what they were ordered to do.
Right.
And there are lots of stories in Saipan about her fate there, and probably some aspect of those stories are correct. That she did crash into the shallow sea of Mini Atoll and was brought by a boat with Japanese soldiers in it and moved 1,000 miles step by step, mile by mile.
Right.
And I've talked with many people, shown them photographs in the island as well as on Saipan. I believe that they believed that they were telling me what they thought was correct. And so, you want to be, in writing a nonfiction book, you want to be as accurate as possible.
Right.
And I've always tried to be, and hopefully by this day and time I've gotten a little better, and I can document my reasoning and my research and my facts to be believable. And so that's what makes a good book a good book.
Dave, it's been an absolute honor to have you aboard the Chasing Earhart podcast. Thank you so much for your time today. I know you have a lot going on, so thank you for sitting in with us today.
Okay, bye.
Thank you for listening to this episode of the Chasing Earhart podcast, part of our Japanese Capture retrospective series. We hope you've enjoyed the show. Come back to ChasingEarhart.com each week for another new podcast. While at ChasingEarhart.com, visit our archives and our blog to hear all of our past episodes and interviews with guests such as Brad Meltzer, Tom Vinson, Candace Fleming, Jessica Cox, Abigail Harrison, and Shasta Ways. You can also hear interviews with representatives of all of the relevant hypotheses regarding the disappearance of Amelia Earhart and Fred Noonan, such as Tom King, Dick Spink, Gary LaPook, Rick Gillespie, Andy Sherrill, and more. Also at our site, you can find hundreds more posts, project updates, and much more information regarding the life and disappearance of Amelia Earhart. The Chasing Earhart podcast is a show without any sponsors or ads. We rely on support from listeners like you to keep the Chasing Earhart project operating. You can donate to the show, and as our thank you, receive bonus podcasts, merchandise, and advanced opportunities for Chasing Earhart events. Find a full list of available shows and rewards at patreon.com/chasingearhart. You can also follow the project on social media, where our team posts all of our shows, news, and project information. And that hashtag is @ChasingEarhart. The Chasing Earhart podcast is produced by Vanessa Williamson and edited by Tom Myers. Podcast music is provided by Dane Jarris Schmidt, and narration is done by Forrest Burgess. The opinions on Chasing Earhart are those of the individual guests and may not reflect those of Chris Evan Films Incorporated. Chris Evan Films Incorporated is not affiliated with the films or clips referred to herein. All movie clips and audio used in this podcast are the intellectual property of their respective copyright holders. They are included here for the purpose of historical education, and no infringement is intended. The Chasing Earhart podcast is an exclusive trademark of Chris Evan Films Incorporated and may not be used without the express written consent of Chris Evan Films Incorporated. All rights reserved. The Chasing Earhart podcast is a Chris Evan Films production. Copyright 2018. All rights reserved.